Though you bring back the sons of Morna and the seven armies of the Fianna, you will not lift this sadness.
Father Michael Flannery. The DIC team's takeoff had been scheduled for 10 a.m. Denver time, but there was a half-hour delay while the flamethrower tanks were redeployed because of a wind shift. Beckett and his three companions waited it out in the plane, conscious of the tanks rumbling as they moved around the airport's perimeter. The plane smelled of jet fuel. An Air Force colonel had set up the flight necessities, briefing Beckett by radio and telephone. "Expect some changes and ambiguities," he had warned. The colonel had pointedly referred to Beckett as Major. Lepikov, overhearing one of these conversations, had asked, "Tell me, Bill, how is it a doctor is also a pilot in your Air Force?" Beckett's answer? "I wanted a second career in case my knife ever slipped." This had aroused no smile from Lepikov, who said, "I think you are more than you appear. Aren't we all?" The plane was a modified Lear with tip tanks and extra tanks inside, which made the cabin a cramped area bound in by new fiberglass walls, behind which the extra fuel could be heard sloshing when the aircraft moved. Choice of the Lear had been motivated by Beckett's experience. He had 21 hours in Lears. His jet ratings also were current for three different fighters, including the old Phantoms, which he admired the way a teenager would admire a hot automobile. Beckett had also once flown an Egyptian Air Force Mirage and said he was looking forward to a proficiency demonstration by the French escort, which would be using relays of the Mirage 3. The extra half hour gave Beckett time to make a careful cockpit check. He went through it methodically, a pattern any of his nurses would have recognized from his operating room behavior. Sectional charts all in order. NOTAMs provided. Weather information current. He noted that the initial altitude would be 35,500 feet, and muttered under his breath. He had asked for clearance to 50. The flight plan had been extended where possible to take them over less populated areas, but it swung past Cleveland and south of Buffalo, then out over Boston. From there it passed south of Greenland and Iceland, then down into the United Kingdom. Barrier Command escorts would take over at Iceland. Beckett had been warned that escort instructions were to shoot down the Lear if it deviated from a 5-mile-wide corridor. The fuel-conserving flight time had been estimated at about 13 hours, putting them at Manchester, England, about 6:30 a.m. local. Barrier Command rockets were scheduled to smash into the Lear 6 minutes after Beckett parked it at the end of the Manchester Strip. Before landing, Beckett's instructions were to dump any excess fuel using a switch system that automatically transmitted a confirmation signal to Barrier Command. "Otherwise, you will be strafed while ground personnel are still in and around the aircraft," the briefing colonel had warned. They were taking no chances that someone on the ground would attempt to hijack the Lear and leave England. As Beckett was finishing the cockpit check, Hupp moved forward and slipped into the right-hand seat.
"Do you mind, Bill?"
"Just don't touch anything." Beckett scanned the instruments. He was glad to see the latest satellite relay navigation screen on the panel. There was a note from the installers giving him a list of the critical deviations. There had been no time to fine-tune the thing. As the booster truck moved into position, its operator wearing a spacesuit and breathing through tanks on the truck, Beckett went through the procedures automatically while his mind read him the flight numbers. 4 hours, 57 minutes, Colorado Springs to Boston. 13 hours, 33 minutes, elapsed time to Manchester. 29 minutes behind the original schedule. Headwinds over the Atlantic. They should be over Boston about 5:30 p.m., and they should have two pilots in this cockpit. He glanced speculatively at Hupp beside him and decided against delegating some of the takeoff routine. Hupp was obviously nervous. Beckett turned back to his instruments and controls, reminding himself that this plane had to be flown Lear fashion. This was a demanding aircraft susceptible to pilot-induced lateral oscillation. He had to be on his toes at every minute during takeoff and landing to avoid a Dutch roll, a half-snap that could whip them into the ground. He had to fly it by the numbers. His earphones told him, "Taxi to runway 35, Mr. Beckett. Your gross weight figures at 12,439 pounds." Beckett made a note of this and responded, "Goodbye, Peterson Field." "Good flight, Major." Beckett recognized the voice of the briefing colonel up there in the tower. Strange that the man had never provided a name. Lots of odd things in this new world. "Activate your special transmitter," the colonel ordered. Beckett flipped a red switch on his panel. "What's that?" Hupp asked. "Our leper's bell." Beckett glanced left and right. "Now shut up until I get a straight and level topside." As the Lear gathered speed down the runway, Beckett saw the flamethrower tanks already speeding into the parking position. Their car, which had been left at the taxi ramp, would get it first. Then the entire area would be washed in flame. Fire carried a sense of cleansing finality, Beckett thought. Burned things tended not to reproduce. The Mirage III escort, four aircraft, was with him before he reached the Thurman intersection outside Denver. He waved at the flanking pilots rather than tip his wings. The pilots gave him a thumbs up before dropping back. One took up station directly behind. Beckett nodded to himself. He had seen the armed rockets under the swept wings. Those rockets were an important reality on this flight. They required some tight navigation from Bill Beckett. The radio interrupted his thoughts with a weather check. Headwinds eased back slightly over the Atlantic, but nothing to cheer about. Beckett heard it out, then thumbed his mic for intercom and said, "Keep your seat belts fastened when you're not in the toilet. No unnecessary moving around. We have uncertain weather off the coast, and I'll have to nurse this bird all the way. We need every ounce of fuel." At 35,000 feet, he leveled off and trimmed, announced his position, then turned to Hupp. "We may not have a piss cup of fuel left when we get there."
"I have confidence in you, Bill. Tell me, what is the leper's bell?"
"We transmit a constant special ID. If it goes silent, whammo." He glanced out at a Mirage III that had taken up position on the right. "Your buddies out there mean business."
"I see the rockets. They would use them."
"You better believe it, Joe."
"You don't mind if I ride up here with you?"
"Glad of the company when I'm not busy. Just keep your feet off those pedals and don't touch the wheel."
"I hear and obey, mon capitaine."
"Very good," Beckett said, grinning and relaxing for the first time since he had climbed into the plane. "Just keep the Foreign Legion in mind and remember how a capitaine punishes disobedience."
"Stretched out in the hot sun for the Berbers," Hupp said. "The vultures waiting. Yes, I have seen that movie."
Beckett thumbed his microphone for a position check from ground stations. Then, "Have you thought what this little trip is costing? This plane, with modifications and all, I'd guess close to 4 million. One trip, and bam! This may be the costliest transatlantic flight in history."
"But first class," Hupp said. "Except in the back. You can hear the fuel moving in those tanks."
"That bothers you?"
"I do not like fire."
"You'd never feel it. Someone once said an airplane is one of the better ways to go. It may kill you, but it won't hurt you." Hupp shuddered.
"I once steered the airplane of a friend near Lyon. I did not like the feeling."
"Some do, some don't. What were you and Sergei and Francois buzzing about back there before we took off?" For answer, Hupp said,
"You have children, Bill?"
"Huh?" "Yeah. Marge and I have two daughters." He crossed his fingers. "And they're still safe, thank God." "What's that have to do with—"
"I have two boys. They are with my family near Bergerac in the Dordogne."
"Are you changing the subject, Joe?"
"Not at all. I like the Bergerac region."
"Cyrano's hometown," Beckett said, deciding to go along with this strange turn in the conversation. "How come you don't have a big nose?"
"I was never asked to hunt truffles as a child."
Beckett emitted a barking laugh, feeling it relieve his tensions. Was that Hupp's motive? Ease things?
"We are a good team, Bill," Hupp said.
"One hell of a team. Even old Sergei back there."
"Ah, poor Sergei. He has convinced himself that he and Ariana would have experienced the grand passion. Death has thwarted the great love story of the age."
"Was that what you were talking about?"
"Only in passing. It is a strange thing about our group. We are fitted to each other in a most remarkable fashion, almost as though fate had designed us to work together on this thing."
"We're going to lick it, Joe."
"I agree. Those two tragic deaths have motivated us in a very powerful way. And the information from the autopsies... my head is buzzing with it. If the liver...
what's it like in the Dordogne?" Beckett interrupted. Hupp glanced at him, remembering the other Beckett under the hot lights of the O.R., the deft and certain movements of his scalpel. Yes. This Beckett here in the aircraft was the one who had cursed Francois.
"Every fall in the Dordogne, we hunt the set mushroom, the Boletus edulis," Hupp said. He touched his fingertips to his lips and blew a kiss. "Bill, when we have triumphed over this plague, you must bring your family. We will have a party. Sep and strawberries, the little frais de bois."
"That's a deal." Beckett paused to make a course correction. The land below him was a patchwork of rectangular farms glimpsed through a partial cloud cover. The Lear felt smooth and steady.
"We are very old-fashioned in the Dordogne," Hupp said. "In France, we are thought of much the way your people think of the hillbillies. My marriage to Yvonne was arranged. We had known each other since childhood, of course."
"No hanky-panky beforehand?"
"In spite of all the stories, we French do not kiss and tell. My lips are sealed."
"An arranged marriage? I thought that went out with tin pants and matching jacket." Hupp looked puzzled.
"Tin pants and... oh, you mean armor?"
He shrugged.
"How old are your daughters, Bill?"
8 and 11. "Why? You thinking of arranging marriages for them?"
"My sons are 14 and 12. Not a bad difference in the ages."
Beckett stared at him. "You serious,
Bill? Have you thought of the kind of world we will enter when we have beaten this plague?"
"A little, yeah."
"It is not good that our team must communicate with the other investigators through the political leaders of our nations.
They're all looking for an advantage."
"The very thing Sergei said. But things are changing. I am serious about our children, Bill. Why shouldn't the intelligent marry their children to children of the intelligent?"
"You know it doesn't work that way, Joe. The offspring wouldn't necessarily..."
"I know the genetic rule, Bill. Deviation to the center. Our grandchildren would tend to be not quite as smart as their parents, perhaps."
"What's on your mind, Joe?"
"The very different world our children will inherit. The pattern is already making itself evident. Small local governments with strong borders. Switzerland's everywhere. Suspicion of strangers."
"With good reason."
"Granted. But consider the consequences if the big governments vanish."
"You really think they're on the way out?"
"It's obvious. Of what use is a big government when a single individual can destroy it? Governments will have to be small enough that you know every one of your neighbors."
"Good God." Beckett took a deep, trembling breath.
"We may achieve a single worldwide currency," Hupp said. "Perhaps an electronic currency. There will still be some trade, I think. But who would dare attack his neighbor when one survivor could exterminate the attackers?"
Yes. But if we can cure... The variations on this plague are infinite, Bill. That's already plain.
There'll still be armies, Beckett said, his tone cynical.
Who would dare maintain a military force when the possession of such a force is an invitation to disaster, keeping your populace in constant peril?
What do you mean?
Your military force cannot practice its arts upon its neighbors. The old weapons are outmoded.
Beckett took his attention off the Lear's course and stared at Hupp.
Jesus Christ, he whispered.
We have opened Pandora's box, Hupp said. This plague is just the first, I fear. Think about it a moment, Bill. The variations on this plague.
One man alone did it, Beckett said, nodding. He glanced out at the Mirage 3 beyond his left wingtip, then back to Hupp.
A police state could... Sergei thinks not. He has been thinking very hard about this matter. He even suspects his masters have a plan to kill off some scientists once they have...
What if they miss the wrong one?
Yes. What if there is another plague, a mutation? And they have no resources with which to meet this threat. Or what are your neighbors doing with their scientists? Oh, no, this tiger has a long tail.
Beckett put the Lear on autopilot and announced this to their escort. He leaned back and clasped his hands behind his head.
The airplane flies itself? Hupp asked, a touch of fear in his voice.
It flies itself.
English has this valuable reflexive form, Hupp said. My thought is expressed better in English, that we ourselves created this madman. We have done this thing to ourselves. We are both action and object.
You've been thinking about this for some time, Beckett said.
I think I know what kind of world our children will inherit.
I only hope they'll inherit any kind of world.
That is the first order of business, yes.
Beckett glanced sideways at Hupp. You were serious about marrying your sons to my daughters.
I am serious. We will find a need to arrange marriages across the new borders. Exogamy is not a new device, Bill.
Yeah. We'll have to keep expanding the gene pool.
Or... suffer genetic deterioration.
Beckett lowered his hands and scanned the instruments. He made a course correction. Presently, he said, we not only need a cure for the plague, we need a medical technique for dealing with the general problem.
Medical?
Hupp asked.
Only medical?
I see what you mean, Joe. Public medicine has always had its political hurdles, but this one...
We think there should be strategically placed centers around the world, tight communications links, a complete computer interchange without regard to national boundaries, voice and video, no censorship. Scientists should join hands with no regard to nationality.
You're dreaming, Joe.
Perhaps.
Our families are hostage to our good behavior, damn it.
And the rest of our world is hostage to its good behavior.
What if some research establishment in the Soviet Union solves it before we do?
It makes little difference as long as many of us know the solution.
Christ! You're talking about a conspiracy of scientists.
Exactly. And any researcher who thinks this thing through will come to our conclusions.
You really think so? Why?
Because there's enormous power in it, and anything else is chaos.
Sergei goes along with this?
Sergei has a fine appreciation for personal power, and he has friends in strategic places within the Soviet Union.
He agrees to plot against his bosses.
He suggests we call it among ourselves the False Godelinsky Cabal.
Cleared his throat.
Your friend, Rockerman,
He's in Washington, and I'm here. But if the opportunity arose, I'll have to think about it. Think long and hard, Bill. Think about all the good things that could be done with this knowledge. Think of the value in such knowledge.
Beckett stared at him.
You surprise me, Joe. I surprise myself. But I think this is a logical answer to giving our children a world they will want to inherit.
Francois, what does he say about it?
You value his opinion?
On this sort of thing, yes.
In a way, you're alike, you and Francois. You are conservatives. It is that which convinced Francois.
He wishes to conserve certain values in our world.
Well, the politicians have sure as hell made a mess of it. Francois said something similar. But then he has not admired a politician since de Gaulle.
Another general, Beckett said.
Like Eisenhower?
Touché.
Then you will think about this?
Yeah.
Good. Where is the autopsy summation? I saw you with it before we left the DIC.
It's in my flight bag, right behind me. Beckett gestured with his elbow. Right on top. It's open. Hupp leaned across the console and slipped a sheaf of papers from the bag behind Beckett's seat. As he did so, he glanced back into the aircraft.
Sergei and Francois are asleep, he said.
Hupp straightened and flattened the papers on his lap. Best thing they could do, Beckett said. He pulled up a sectional chart and took an RDF bearing for his position.
Where are we?
Hupp asked. He looked down, seeing cloud cover bright in the sunlight. We'll be crossing Mansfield, Ohio, pretty soon. We have to head north there to miss Pittsburgh. Hupp looked at the autopsy report in his lap.
Is it true, Bill? He asked. That you cried when Ariana died?
Is that what Francois said?
He said you cursed him and you cried, and he said it was an admirable thing in you. The passing of a friend should not go unremarked.
That lady had balls, Beckett muttered.
If I am not for myself, who is for me? But if I am for myself alone, who am I?
Hillel. Hols Anders Bergen turned off all of his office lights and strode to the window, knowing the way even in darkness. New York street lights from the United Nations Plaza far below filled the foggy night with a faint glow, an underlighted silvery movement, vaporous and mysterious. Although he knew the temperature had not changed in the office, he felt suddenly cold. For more than an hour he had been going over and over in his mind that afternoon's press conference. The well-known Kissinger admonition was much in his thoughts.
It is a mistake to assume everything said in a press conference is fully considered.
But all of his staff had agreed that something had to be said to the reporters. He had chosen to make it a background briefing, something they could credit to a high official of the United Nations.
Too many delicate unknowns complicated the world scene. There was too much secrecy. He had chosen to part the veils slightly.
There had been the preliminary report of the archaeologists who had been called in to sift the ashes of the burned-out house in Seattle. There was a touch of brilliance in that decision, he thought.
Archaeologists.
Brave men. They had known they could not return to their families. The foggy curtain outside his window thinned somewhat in a drift of wind, giving him a glimpse of a convoy far below moving out toward the end of the island. That would be their military guardians changing shifts. With its tunnels blocked and the bridges down, Manhattan was now considered a fairly secure bastion. There were still some burned-out pockets within the city, and only official traffic moved on the streets at night, but it had shaken down into a new pattern that some were calling secure. It was a false security, Bergen thought. The military cordon drew a jagged line around the city, extending into New Jersey from near Red Bank west to Bound Brook, swinging northward there along the Watchung Mountains to Patterson. Then, growing increasingly erratic, it meandered over the New York-New Jersey boundary through White Plains and out to Long Island Sound, north of Port Chester. The flame wall, people called it, taking their sense of security from the image of the wide, blackened barrier beyond this land, a place where ashes drifted across mounds of ruins and the unburied bodies of those who had perished on that ground. Bergen did not like to think of the human deaths represented by the flame wall, the ones killed in its creation, and the ones who had died trying to cross it into the sanctuary of New York. Barriers, he thought. Everything was barriers in this new world. Identity cards and barriers. You could be summarily shot for not possessing a valid identity card. Barrier Command had set the pattern. Within the reassurance of that label, there lay a nasty sound to Bergen's ears. He pictured the naval blockade around Ireland and Great Britain, the combined naval and land blockade around North Africa. Massive was the only word for it. The glowing face of Bergen's wristwatch told him it was only 8:53 p.m., less than 3 hours since he had measured his press conference performance against the evening's television reports. The anchorman had parroted the words of the high official. Essentially, we ignored a crucial thing happening in technology and scientific research. We failed to see the central bearing of this factor on all international affairs. To my knowledge, not a single high official in any government seriously considered that one individual alone could create such devastating chaos as this man O'Neill has done. The next question had been anticipated, and the answer carefully prepared. The evidence is overwhelming that it was this John Roe O'Neill, and that he acted alone. They had not expected him to be open and candid about the findings in Seattle. There is virtually conclusive evidence that the Ballard basement is where he concocted his devilish brew.
Sir?
Brew?
Singular.
That had been a balding reporter from the Post. We cannot be certain, Bergen had admitted. The conference had moved then into the area that had prompted Bergen to call it, defying the President of the United States and a half-dozen prime ministers. North Africa, and now the Saudis. Led by the Soviet delegation, he had told the reporters, there is pressure for a drastic change of tactics in North Africa and surrounding regions. After all of the years of carefully censoring his words, it had felt good to Bergen just to say this, speaking out truthfully and with no diplomatic embroidery. Let them vote me out, he thought. The Rommel campaign had been a clear demonstration that desert patrols could be penetrated. The British had moved in and out of Rommel's lines. And now, the Saudi problem had to be confronted in the light of that knowledge. How bad was the contamination? Israel was threatening atomic sterilization of its borders, a clear Talmudic fist being shaken in the direction of Saudi Arabia. The only thing holding them back was the madman's threat. Would this atomic sterilization be considered an act against the targets of O'Neill's revenge? There had been an untallied number of Libyans among the Mecca pilgrims. And what about the source of the contamination, North Africa? The Russians wanted a ring of fire, another flame barrier. It was their euphemism for a plan to put a linked series of outposts around the land perimeter. Flamethrowers, radar, day and night air patrols. Damn the cost, they said. We're talking about survival. The real question, though, was where would their perimeter be drawn? The Saudi problem threw this issue into high relief. Israel had its own suspicions about where the Soviet Union wanted to install its ring of fire. Hysteria is infectious, Bergen thought. The United States wanted a ribbon track of cobalt dust around the area, a radioactive moat that no life could cross and survive. This told Bergen, among other things, that the United States had squirreled away a large stockpile of such dust. He had argued that radioactive contamination of the entire Mediterranean basin would be an inevitable consequence. Israel had been outraged. What choice did they have, the United States had asked. What other decisions made sense now that Turkey, Lebanon, Syria, and southern Italy were being written off? Only Israel remained as a fragile island of plague-free land within that contaminated region. And how plague-free were they? No outside observers were being permitted to investigate. As the French ambassador had said at their morning meeting, "Losses are inevitable. The sooner we accept them, the better." He had cited Brittany, Cyprus, and Greece as his supporting arguments. All of this Bergen had told the press, speaking plainly and without the usual euphemisms. He had held back only on the heated argument between the French and the Israelis. Name-calling was not a new thing within the United Nations walls, but this had transcended past performances. "You are anti-Semitic animals," the Israeli had shouted. Oddly, the Frenchman had responded only, "France, too, is a Mediterranean nation. Whatever we do there will have its effect upon us." The Israeli would not accept this. "Don't think you fool us. France has a long history of anti-Semitism." It was understandable that tempers were short, Bergen thought. Somehow, diplomacy had to survive despite this atmosphere. They did not dare go their separate ways. Could Israel be relocated in the Brazilian heartland, as had been suggested? A new diaspora? It might come to that, Bergen thought, even though Brazil said it could take no more than half of Israel's population, and there were a multitude of strings attached to the offer. Brazil, of course, was looking at Israel's atomic capability. Bergen thought of the Israelis sitting there in their desert oasis, their atom bombs wrapped in the Talmud. An excitable people, he thought. There was no telling how they might respond to such an international decision. And Brazil, had it really considered what it might be letting within its borders? It was Bergen's opinion that Brazil would become the new Israel, that there would be no way to confine such resourceful people. And there were so many unknowns. What was really going on within Israel's borders? They would have to permit outside inspection, and soon. He put aside the Brazilian suggestion, although it had excited the media. An interesting distraction, perhaps, but the magnitude of such a move made Bergen shudder. As he had been expecting, the red telephone's light came on and its chime sounded. Bergen returned to his chair and lifted the phone from its cradle. Prescott surprised him immediately. "That was a damn smart move going public that way, Hab." Familiarity. Something was cooking, as the Americans were fond of saying. "I'm glad you think so, Adam. I must confess I was a bit uncertain of your reaction." The president produced a mild chuckle. "My old mother used to say that when things start to stick to the bottom of the pot, you give it a brisk stir." Cooking, indeed, Bergen thought. He said, "I had something on that order in my mind." "Knew you did. I told Charlie that was what you were doing. Tell me, Hab, what's your reading on this Admiral Francis Delacourt?" Bergen recognized the tone. Prescott was getting right to the point. Barrier Command's chief was an obvious question mark. A lot of power sitting out there on its own in Iceland. The Secretary General did not envy Delacourt, especially now with Prescott probably gunning for him. "He seems to be doing a pretty good job, Adam." "Pretty good? Something bothering you, Adam?" That was an advantage of the familiar, Bergen thought. You could ask the loaded question without any resort to diplomatic niceties. "He's French back there somewhere, isn't he?" Prescott asked.
"His family came from Quebec, yes."
"I hear he's a historian." Bergen recalled Delacourt's statement accepting the Barrier Command post. There had been a pedantic tone in it. It's the same problem the Romans had, but with modern tools.
My sources say he's quite a respectable historian, Adam,
Bergen agreed.
Patton was a historian, Prescott said.
Patton?
Oh, yes, the World War II tank commander. And there had been something at the time about Patton admiring the Romans. Quite a few military leaders have had that hobby, Bergen said.
Bothers me, Prescott said. Is he going to have delusions of grandeur, too?
Too? Bergen wondered.
Was that how Prescott thought of Patton?
I've seen no signs of that, Bergen said.
I think we should keep an eye on him, Prescott said. And then the kicker. The Russians have just been talking to us about him. He worries them, too. And by the way, Hab, I had the devil's own time smoothing them down. They were really upset by your off-the-record briefing today.
It's good to have you on my side, Adam.
Depend on it, Hab. Well, Nuff said. Why don't you get out the Admiral's general orders and have another look at them?
I'll do that, Adam. Anything special I should look for?
Damn. You talk just like an American sometimes, Prescott said. I've nothing special there, nothing in mind at the moment. I just think we should start making sure he has to second-guess us, not the other way around.
I'll make it a point to give his performance my special attention, Bergen said.
You do that, Hab. And while you're at it, you might look into the rumor that Delacorte's boys have sunk a few coffin ships with all their occupants aboard.
Ah, I hadn't heard that rumor, Adam.
New? It just surfaced. Well, good talking to you, Hab. Long as we stay clean, we may get in that golf game yet.
They broke the connection.
Bergen got out his copy of Delacorte's general orders and read them over twice. They were pretty direct. If you make physical contact with any person from the prescribed areas, your own people will kill you or drive you onto the shore, where the inhabitants likely will do the job for us.
That paragraph, for instance. There was no mistaking its meaning.
Bergen sat back and thought about Delacorte. It was pretty clear that the Admiral thought of his problem as deer stalking in the coves and inlets of those rocky coasts.
A game?
If so, death was the price of failure. The same problem the Romans had, but with modern tools.
Tools?
Was that how Delacorte thought of battleships and all the rest of it? Tools? All of that firepower. Then again, perhaps he was right. Caesar had probably thought in a similar way. And what did the coffin ships have to do with Prescott's concerns? Bergen did not want to think about the coffin ships, but there was no avoiding it now. Did it matter, in the larger sense, if Delacorte's people sank some of those ships with occupants aboard? Morally, yes, it mattered, but
the ships themselves were a necessity.
God alone knew what the madman might learn.
He had to be obeyed.
The Irish must all go back to Ireland, the Libyans back to Libya, and the British back to their little island.
It was utter madness.
The reports made Bergen sick. Mobs hunting the poor refugees. French mobs, Spanish mobs, German mobs, Canadian mobs, American mobs, Mexican mobs, Japanese mobs. Even in China and Australia and probably everywhere else. The anguish and terror were so awful that blame had to be lodged somewhere. Television coverage of the wrenching embarkations had brought tears to Bergen's eyes. He knew there were instances of brave defiance around the world, babies, women, and children being hidden. But the hysteria and savagery, suicides, murders, lynchings, those were the dominant pattern.
And we thought we were civilized.
Coffin ships. Every female aboard being sent home to certain death. And there were stories, rapes, torture, The floating prisons were forced to anchor offshore at their destinations, passengers driven ashore in small boats by gunfire. The Secretary General shuddered. The many suicides were understandable. Perhaps sinking the ships was a mercy. Sighing, Bergen turned on the single low swing lamp at the side of his desk and centered it over his blotter. Methodically, he took a notepad and wrote a brief order to an aide. Delacorte's behavior would have to be scrutinized. When he had finished the order, he put both palms flat on the blotter and forced himself to think about the priorities. The Saudis and Israel. Number one. Ring of fire or a cobalt moat? He feared there would be no pulling of rabbits out of hats here. Whatever they did, it would be a monumental mess. Another Kissinger comment came unbidden to Bergen's mind. The difficulties in the Middle East occurred not because the parties don't understand each other, but in some respects, because they understand each other only too well. Cobalt radioactivity would be sure to spread. The American experts admitted it. If it destroyed the usefulness of Saudi oil, would the Soviets pick up the slack as they had hinted? Bergen was tempted to laugh hysterically and say, "Tune in tomorrow at this same time." No vapid American soap opera had ever contemplated such monumental disaster. A trembling anger overcame him then. Why should the Secretary General have sole responsibility for such terrible decisions? It was too much. He had to admit, then, that, in all honesty, he did not have sole responsibility. Decision-making worked on a different system nowadays. Abruptly, he turned to the red phone and lifted it out of the open drawer onto the desk, keying the sophisticated scrambler equipment as he did this. A United States Navy communications officer answered on the first ring. He identified himself as Lieutenant Commander Avery. "May I speak to the President?" Bergen asked.
"One moment, sir. He's at Camp David."
The President's voice sounded alert and curious. "Something new come up, Hab?" Still familiarity. Good. "Adam, I forgot to ask whether the Russians discussed your cobalt suggestion when they called."
"Oh, glad you brought that up."
Prescott did not sound at all glad. "There's a big argument between them and the Chinese over it. The Chinese favor our suggestion. If we decide on the cobalt, Adam, could we announce at the same time that air transport from all over the world is standing by to remove the Israelis to Brazil in an orderly manner? That's quite a mouthful, Hab.
But could we do it?"
"You could say it, but it might not be true."
"We must do our best.
The Jews have suffered too much. We can't abandon them.
The way we did with the Greeks, the Cypriots, and some others."
"Those others did not have atomic weapons." "That sounds rather cold-blooded," Prescott said.
"I don't mean it that way. We have to address these emergencies by a priority system, which we both understand very well. Will you do your part in this, Adam?"
"Shared responsibility," Prescott said.
"That's what I had in mind, Adam."
"I'll do my best, Hab." As the President returned his phone to the cradle in the lounge of the main lodge at Camp David, he looked at Charlie Turkwood, who stood at the fireplace, back to the flames. "That son of a bitch Bergen just called in his counter," Prescott said. "And it's a doozy."
"The past is dead."
Arab proverb. The metal bed of the lorry was chilling beneath John's bare skin. He curled himself into a tight ball, his arms hugged around his chest, but the lorry's movement jostled him, and a cold wind blew through the canvas cover over the bed. They had stripped him bare on the float at Kinsale, parceling out his clothes and the contents of his pack, arguing over who would get the 6 French chocolate bars. Kevin O'Donnell had appeared uninterested in all of this, but he had kept the money and the Belgian pistol. "Why are you doing this?" John had demanded.
Because we're kindly men, Kevin O'Donnell had said. We kill anyone we catch within 500 meters of the shore. Even if we come in from the sea? Well, me and the boys were disappointed in you, Yank. We were expecting some folks from another coffin ship. Maybe a pretty woman or two. One of the men stripping John said, Not many women surviving the trip any more. They finished with him, removing even his shoes and socks. He stood, hugging himself, bare and shivering on the cold float. Just be happy we're sparing you, Yank, Kevin O'Donnell had said. Up you go, Yank. Into the lorry with him, boys. And this time, bring some of the good stuff back with you. Three guards had entered the back of the lorry with John. He caught the name of only one, Muirish Cone, a small man with a face that appeared compressed from top to bottom, the closely set eyes too near the nose too close to the mouth, and the chin almost touching his lower lip. While the three guards occupied a bench on one side, John was forced to stay on the chilled bed. When he complained of the cold, Cone nudged him roughly with a heavy boot and said, Now you heard, Kevin. You're alive, and it's more than you deserve. To John, the trip drew itself out into an interminable frigid torture, which he endured by promising himself he would live, and, if his story was believed, he would work his way into whatever the Irish were doing to solve the plague problem. There, he would sabotage that effort. The lorry went first up a steep hill, rolling John toward the back. His captors dragged him forward again, wedging him near their feet. "Which way are we going?" one of them asked the others. "I heard them say the road through Belgooly is safest," Cone said. "That means they've restored Five-Mile Bridge," the questioner said. He was silent for a moment. Then, "How long will we be stopping in Cork?" "Now, Gilly," Cone said, "the times you've made this trip and you still asking such a question. I've a thirst the River Lee itself, and it running full in the spring could not wet," the questioner said. "And you'll have to wait until we rid ourselves of this lout," Cone said. He kicked John in the shoulder. "We'll get as wet as the seas themselves on the way back. It's either that or answer to Kevin himself, which I'll not be doing. Him in a mad mood, as you could see." John, sensing a faint warmth from his captor's feet, wriggled closer, but Cone felt the movement in the darkness and thrust him away with one foot, sneering, "Keep your stinking self away from us, Yank. I'll be bathing for a week just to get the smell of you off me feet." John found himself wedged against a metal support post for the bench on his side of the lorry's bed. The sharp edge of the post cut into his back, but it was a different pain from the cold. He focused on this new pain. Clinging to it. The darkness, the cold, the pain began to work on him. He had thought O'Neill safely buried deep within, obscured and hidden away forever. But his nakedness, the dark and cold bed of the lorry, these were not a place he had ever imagined. He could feel a terrible inner warfare waiting to occur, and he began to hear the lunatic sound of that inner voice, John Roe O'Neill, clamoring for his revenge. "You'll have it," he muttered. The sound of his voice was almost covered by the grinding rumble of the lorry as it climbed a hill. Cone heard him, though, and asked, "Did you say something, Yank?" When John did not answer, Cone kicked him. "I'll have an answer from you, damn your evil soul." "It's cold," John said. "Ah, that's fine now," Cone said. "We wouldn't want you to enter our world comfortable-like." Cone's companions laughed. "It's the way we all enter Ireland, you know," Cone said. "Naked as plucked chickens and them ready for the pot. You've no mind for the pot you're in now, you Yankee devil." They fell silent then, and John lapsed back into the arena of his inner war. He could feel the presence of O'Neill. It was a single eye like a beam of light glaring from within his head. No warmth in it. Cold. Cold. As cold as the metal upon which his body lay. The lorry rumbled across a wooden bridge, and the sound of the tires against the planks was a drumbeat in John's head.
He could sense O'Neill trying to emerge, and this terrified him. O'Neill did not belong here. O'Neill would scream. The three guards would enjoy that. Lights. He sensed lights out the open rear of the lorry, and this restored him somewhat. He realized that his eyes were tightly closed, and slowly he opened them. O'Neill sank back into obscurity. The lights were on both sides of the lorry, a well-lighted city street. He could hear people shouting. It was a drunken sound. There was a gunshot, then high-pitched laughter. He tried to sit up, but Cone pushed him back with a foot. "Painted like hussies," one of the other guards said. John felt a crouching sensation. Had some of the women survived? That high-pitched laughter. Had his plague failed? Would they were hussies, Cone said. I'd even welcome old Bella Cone in the manto, the saucy darlings beckoning us with their skirts lifted. It'd be better than this, the other guard said. Men with men. It's against the commandments, Mwirish. It's all they have, Gilly, Cone said. They haven't our opportunities to get a warm woman into bed. It's the burying of him afterwards I don't like, the other guard said. Why didn't the sanctuary save him, Wirish? Oh, it's a terrible, virulent thing, this plague. A short life. Better it be merry, as the poet said. I'll never lay with a man, Gilly said. Save that for the time when the coffin ships come no more, Gilly. Cone slid back along the bench past John and peered out the rear of the lorry. Isn't it a shame? The fine city of Cork come to this. He returned to the others. Did you hear that the English Queen died? Gilly asked. Good riddance. Best see an end to the House of Windsor. The lorry made a slow, tight turn to the left, and the driver shifted down for a hill. The guards lapsed into silence. John kept his eyes open, watching the shadows on the canvas overhead. The lorry picked up speed along smooth paving. The N-25's mostly clean now, Cone said. We'll be in y'all soon enough. Then it's back to the bright lights, hey, Gilly? I think it was the devil kissed your mother, Gilly said. Cone laughed. And maybe he did a bit more, eh? Have you the cloven hoof, Mwirish? I know how to survive in these times, Gilly. You just be remembering that. Kevin and me, we know the ways that are needed now. Gilly did not answer. In spite of the pain and the cold, John felt himself dozing. It had been a long, tiring time at the sailboat's tiller, and then the shock of his reception. His eyes closed. He opened them quickly, willing them to stay open despite fatigue. He did not want O'Neill to return. They passed an occasional vehicle going the other way, and the lights through the canvas cover showed the guards with their eyes closed. Once a car overtook them, moving very fast, its lights flashing into the lorry's rear, then darkness. The car's motor whined in very high revolutions. "From Dublin," Cone said. "I saw the flag on its fender." "It was doing at least 200," Gilly said. "All of that," Cone said. "They move very fast to our superiors." Three times the lorry slowed to a lurching crawl over rough ground before returning to the smooth pavement. The fourth time it slowed, Cone said the one word, "Y'all." "I'll be glad to load and turn around," Gilly said. "And be shut of this baggage," Cone said, nudging John with a foot. John felt them making a sweeping turn to the left, then low gears for about 5 minutes. They came to a jerking stop, and someone up front shouted, "Get him out!" Cone leaped over the tailgate, and there was the sound of his feet on gravel. Presently, Cone said, "All right, let's have him." The two guards remaining with John had to help him to his feet. His voice not unkind, Gilly said, "Out you go, Yank. Mind the gravel on your feet." John let himself down over the tailgate, moving stiffly, his muscles cramped with the cold and inactivity. Cone took his left arm above the elbow and led him fast around the lorry into the headlights. Limping and stumbling on gravel and broken blacktop, John was glad to stop. The lorry's lights carved out two tunnels of insect-populated brilliance, glimpses of bush-overgrown embankments on both sides of the road. He could hear a river somewhere off to the right. Cone pointed to the direction revealed by the lights.
"There's the direction you go, Yank. Don't come back this way. That's the black water below you there. Keep it on your right until you cross the bridge. There's a stone hut about a mile up. The priests keep a store of clothing there for them as gets that far. There may be something to fit your ugly flesh. And one more thing, Yank. If anyone should ask, it was Kevin O'Donnell of the Clohine O'Donnells who spared your stupid life. If I know Kevin, he didn't want the wasting of a good bullet on his conscience. Me, I expect to see your dead body floating down the Blackwater."
Trembling with the cold, John stuttered, "Where do I go?"
"To hell for all of me. Move smartly now."
Stumbling painfully on the broken surface, John set off up the road. He heard the lorry turn around behind him, its lights gone quickly, the sound of it lasting only a bit longer. He was alone in darkness on a road sparsely illuminated by a broken cup of moon revealed occasionally when clouds were swept clear of it. Tall trees in heavy leaf bowered the road for most of the way. The road angled to his left slowly, then right. He felt ridiculous, angry, and powerless. What did I expect? He wondered. Not this. The road began to climb steadily, and, the clouds passing, he emerged from the covering trees to find the way a thin ribbon through gorse, a bridge directly ahead across the river, and a Y branching just beyond. The left-hand way was blocked by a jumble of fallen trees, and there was the heavy smell of something rotten. John made his way cautiously across the river bridge, and, as he neared the blockaded road, saw a naked body hanging in the tangle of trees. It was bloated, and the flesh falling away. He hurried past, coming on a steeper climb, hills rising sharply on both sides of the road. The cold moonlight revealed leafless trees sheathed in ivy, a witch barrier on the heights. Both feet were bleeding by now, but he forced himself to ignore the pain, trying to move as silently as he could. What had killed that man back there? He felt that the body had been left there as a warning. They don't expect me to survive very long. At the top of the hill he came out into an open area where the grass had been burned away all around a stone hut that stood in a depression off to his right. The moonlight revealed a flat stone-and-mortar construction with a lean-to shelter at the rear. There was the burned ruin of a house directly across the road from it. What should I do? He thought that if he entered the hut he might encounter an occupant who would kill him the minute he entered. But Cone had said something about priests. "Hello, the hut!" John called. There was no response. Stone paving marked a narrow path between burned bushes down to the hut. I must have clothing and shoes. Cautiously he limped down the stone path to the black oblong of a doorway. He put a hand out to the latch, but before he could lift it, the door creaked open. A candle flared, and he discerned a brown-faced man in a black cassock. The candle held high. The man stared back at John without a word. John found his voice.
"They said I... some clothing?"
The cassocked man stood aside, nodding John into the hut. The dark figure closed the creaking door, put the candle on a wall bracket shelf, and went through a low opening into the shed at the rear of the hut. He returned presently with a mound of clothing in his arms. John accepted the clothing, noting then the empty look in his benefactor's eyes. Blind? No. The cassocked figure moved with too much purpose, and he had known where to put the clothes in John's hands. John looked around him, found a low chair on his left beneath the candle. He put the clothing there and began dressing. The underwear was a full suit of long johns, white and soft. He felt better the minute he had pulled this garment over his chilled body. There was a pair of black and gray tweed trousers, a rough woolen shirt of dark green, a yellow woolen pullover. John stared at his companion while he dressed.
"Are you a priest?"
John asked. Without speaking, the man inclined his head in agreement.
"Have you taken a vow of silence?"
John asked. Again, the head inclined. John looked down at his bruised and bleeding feet. The priest also looked down.
"Do you have shoes?"
John asked. Once more the cassocked man went into the shed at the rear, merging with the shadows there. Spooky, the silent way he moved, John thought. There was a thud, then a creaking sound from the shed. Presently the priest emerged, carrying a pair of worn brogans and a pair of thick socks in green wool. John accepted them gratefully. He sat on the low chair to ease the socks over his sore feet. The brogans felt long enough, but too wide. It helped when he tightened the shoelaces. All this time the priest stood silently above him. John stood. "I've come from the States to help where I can," he said. "I'm a molecular biologist. Is there a research establishment of some kind where..." The priest held up a hand for silence. One hand went under the cassock and emerged with a small notepad and a pencil attached to it by a short length of string. The priest scribbled on the pad and passed it to John. Taking it to the candle, John read, "Take the Capuquin Road. There are signs. Go on to Carr. Ask there." The priest removed the pad from John's hands, tore off the used page, and held it to the candle flame. He let it burn in the candle holder. When the paper had been consumed, he went to the door and opened it. Leading John outside, he pointed to the road leading off beyond the hilltop. John could see the way entering a stretch of high hedges there, the growth black in the moon shadows. "Capuquin," John said. The priest nodded, and once more a hand went under the cassock. Expecting the notepad, John almost missed the long knife when it came slashing out at him from beneath the cassock. John jerked backward, the knife narrowly missing his throat. His assailant merely stood there, the knife held motionless at the end of its swing. Never taking his attention from the man, John stumbled backward up the stone path to the road. All that time, the cassocked figure stood there, a lethal statue. At the road, John turned and ran toward the hedge-bordered stretch. The road dipped and then rose. John ran, panting and glancing backward whenever he could, stopping only when he came out of the hedges onto another hilltop where the road curved left along a ridge. He sat down on a stone wall to catch his breath and keep watch back along the way he had come. There was no sound of pursuit. Was that really a priest back there? An insane priest, perhaps? Then John knew. He expected me to be killed. It was quiet on the hilltop, only a faint soughing of wind in the gorse. He was thankful for the warm clothing. The attack at the hut was unsettling, though. Things were not what they appeared here. When he had recovered his breath, John set off more slowly. "But I'm here," he thought. The clothing on his body smelled of fresh laundering and sun-drying. It felt warm but unfamiliar, and he suddenly realized there wasn't a scrap of identification on his person. Cohn had been right about that. John was freshly born in Ireland. The best hiding place in all the world. John Roe O'Neill could watch the working of his revenge here, and no one the wiser. O'Neill within made no response, and for this John was thankful. Daylight found him in another river valley. He stopped at a rusted gate that once had been painted white. Brick pedestals stood on each side, their mortar falling away in irregular patches. On the far side of the gate, an overgrown single track with grass on the crown led away into thick stands of maple and pine. Nettles and mallow bordered the edges of the track. John glimpsed stone shapes rising from the growth off to his left and realized he was looking at a cemetery. He felt weak with hunger, and his throat was dry. "Capuquin?" he wondered.
Would it be safe to go where the cassocked man had directed him? Who do I dare ask? Anyone he met here could be dangerous. That was the lesson of the cassocked man's knife. Perhaps that had been the intention. The river below the road beckoned him. He would have cold water to allay his thirst. I'll get a drink of water, he thought. Then I can decide what to do.